Hey everybody, JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce, another Baseball America Prospect Podcast special edition this week. You're going to get a couple. It's the World Series week. You're going to get a couple of World Series themed podcasts. We're going to do a World Series preview. Going to have a special guest for that one. That will be kind of pretty cool, I hope. But today we are talking about the Dodgers and the Blue Jays and kind of asking the question, you know, how did they get here? But we don't mean how did they get through the playoffs. We mean, how did they get here from the standpoint of how did they build these teams? We're going to talk some about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as a prospect and Shohei Ohtani as a prospect and the Dodgers rotation and Trey Savage and things like that. We're going to kind of have a little bit of a retrospective look. And I say that, Jeff, I would say I'm guessing that your house was one of the louder ones during game seven, because you do have a son who very much enjoyed the result, it seems like.
Yes. My youngest son, who's the most into sports and particularly baseball, had a blast over the last 2 days. You know, it wasn't just Monday where obviously they make the World Series, and at 10 years old, he dropped to his knees and was very dramatic, as if he had waited 50 years for his team to make it. I think I reacted with less vigor after the Red Sox broke the curse. But like, he was really excited. It was honestly a lot of fun. It was two, you know, fun games if you were cheering for the Blue Jays. And, you know, I've covered this organization for all, you know, four, now going on 5 years. Here at BA, and you know, I enjoy it. I enjoy this fan base. I think they're one of the, you know, shouldn't be shocked they're Canadian, but you know, one of the nicer fan bases to deal with. They always show up for my chats, and you know, I get an opportunity a couple times a month to talk some prospects on, you know, Sportsnet and some of their pregame shows and stuff like that. So I'm appreciative to, you know, the Blue Jays and the opportunity that fan base has given me to, you know, cover their team. And I'm glad that, you know, some of these positive thoughts I've had over the last couple of years look a little bit less rosy, I guess, because I do think, and we'll get into it, I do think they do things in their own way. They're not perfect, but they are an organization that's been looking to win.
We have two organizations here that, again, they look to win, they spend, and we're going to talk about that some. But I think the perfect place for us to start here, we're going to start with, got a piece up at baseballamerica.com as you listen to this or as you watch this on YouTube, that goes through where we ranked every player on the projected World Series rosters, 52 players. We're projecting them. We're basically just saying we'll update it, but the LCS rosters will serve as our likely World Series rosters. Bo Bichette, we will add on there at some point. If he does get added to the roster, that'll add another top 100 prospect to it. But to just kind of run through the numbers a little bit for that, and then we're going to talk about the top players from that. So 18 of the 52 players made a top 100, which, and I would say that the names are some of the ones that you would expect. So you have Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Shohei Ohtani, Clayton Kershaw, Blake Snell, Freddie Freeman, Tyler Glasnow, George Springer, Kevin Gausman. These are all top 20 prospects in the game at some point. You know, then you also got Mookie Betts was not a top 20 prospect in the game. He kind of was a bloomer, you know, but we did have him in the top 100. We had Alejandro Kirk in the top 100, Will Smith in the top 100, Jeff Hoffman, Andres Jimenez, Dalton Varsho, Max Scherzer, as you would expect. You know, Anthony Bonda. Okay, that's maybe the one that maybe we might not expect now, but he was a big deal at one point. But so those are all top 100 prospects. I'm going to play a little trivia question with you, Jeff. You know, this is, I'm going to put you on the spot here. And there's no way. I will not let you dangle on this hook for long, because this one's an impossible question, I will say. So of the 52 players, there are only 10 who did not rank in a team top 30 at some point. You know, we do our Dodgers top 30, Blue Jays top 30, Marlins top 30 every year. 10 players didn't make that. Now, three of those never were eligible. We wrote up as international reports, Yariel Rodriguez, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, and Hee-Sung Kim. But those players came over as foreign professionals, and we now no longer rank those as prospects. So, okay, that so now we're down to seven, right? There are seven players who didn't rank in a top 30. Kike Hernandez, we apologize. That is the name that I would say without a doubt I look back on, and that's a that's the one that's a regret, right? That's the one that I would say. And I would also say Isaiah Kiner-Falefa never made a top 30 for us. And in hindsight, that's a miss on our part. We'll own that. But both of those had draft reports. And every one of the other ones, other than this one player, had a draft report. We have a report on him from a trade. So I do have a scouting report in there that we did write up of him when he was a minor leaguer. Any guess of who would be the one player who neither was a top 30 prospect and never a draft scouting report, which means you were a top 500 prospect in the draft?
So I liked this guy as a breakout reliever, but I think he might have already passed his limits, or I want to say that I pushed Kyle to put him onto a list at one point, but I think it's Alex Vesia.
You are dead on accurate. Well done, sir.
I actually did my pre-show work, so I looked at all the stuff that you sent over, so I knew the answer.
Okay, so you had Alex Vesia is the only player who never, did not. And again, we have a report on him. He was traded from the Marlins to the Dodgers, did a full report at that point, but he is not one who has a full report. So all of those, we have pulled out scouting reports from that for everyone, all 52 players over there. Actually, probably 53, because I'm going to put Bo Bichette on that just in case it gets added. So you'll have that. But what we're going to start with here are two prospects who were at the top of the top of the heap. And we're going to start with, I will say that when Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who was number one on our Baseball America Top 100, but when Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was coming up through the minor leagues, he was a star for what? Like, obviously, he was the son of Vladimir Guerrero Sr. Does help some name recognition there. But on top of that, though, Vlad was the best pure hitter everywhere he ever played, I would say the way to put it. And you look back on it now. When I look back on it now, it's like there are still, even now, like in thinking back on it, where there are parts of this where you say, wow, like, for instance, okay, we've seen what he's done in the postseason and all, but his last season in the minor leagues, he hit 381, 437, 636. The 381 is the number that you're like, wait, did I hear that right? Like, players do not hit 380 in a minor league season. We are gushing about Connor Griffin this year, rightfully. And we're talking about, did you see that Connor Griffin hit over 320 in the minor leagues, as a teenager? Well, in Vlad's case, his version of that is, did you see that I hit 381 in the minors up to AAA as a teenager? Like, there was a reason that he was the number one prospect in game. There was a reason he was a slam dunk minor league player of the year that year. But the thing that stands out is, here we are, and he is what everyone expected him to be, which is harder to do, I would say, Jeff, than, yes, you could say, well, he was expected to be this, but doing that is really hard. What, like, you are perfectly positioned in this time to be part of the Vlad mania. And to see, like, when he was really breaking out as a prospect, what do you remember? What kind of stands out to you from when Vladimir, by the way, and we have a piece up, a little social media post about, do you remember whose manager was at AA? John Schneider. So,
I could name the 2018 New Hampshire Fisher Cats roster front and back. In fact, so this is kind of going back in, like, my story, my background. When I first really tried to make the jump, right before I started Prospects Live. So, like, months before I started Prospects Live, I really tried to make the jump from writing about fantasy to writing about real life prospects. I was doing a podcast at the time for the website that I was at with Lance Brozdowski of Marquee Sports. So Lance was trying to do the same thing that I was. We were kind of getting into it, and we were kind of gifted with all these prospects in our backyard, because not only was Vlad and Bo Bichette and some other players in New Hampshire, you had Brendan Rodgers in Hartford, who was a big deal at the time. So it was always worthwhile to go out to Hartford games if they were playing against New Hampshire and see those guys again. And Rafael Devers was actually in Portland. So that Eastern League that year was really, really loaded with some big names. But I'll say to this day, I don't think I've ever seen a batting practice, as in the minor leagues at least, as good as Vlad Guerrero Jr.'s batting practice that year. I've never seen a hit tool that was as good. You know, you quoted the numbers. That was after he jumped to AAA, and I think he was 19. He hit 406.
402 at AA.
He hit 402, you know, for a majority of that season, 60-plus games. And then
I 61 think had a, games, 402. By the way, 27 strikeouts over that time.
Yeah.
So,
like
14 homers, 14 homers, 27 strikeouts.
And I think you, like, this is the other part of that too, is the first 2 to 3 weeks of that season in particular was incredibly cold in New Hampshire and Hartford. That I actually remember a game in Hartford where the lineup had Lourdes Gurriel Jr. was on that team in the lineup. Jonathan Davis, who was like a leadoff hitter for that team, kind of like a bench guy. Harold Ramirez, Bo Bichette, and then the other side was like Rogers, Grant,
the speedy light guy who, light hitting guy who,
yes, exactly. From
Garrett Hampson.
There we go. We're all on in the lineup that night, and it was 25 degrees, and there were piles of snow in the seats because it had just snowed. So he was, and like, remember, there were no homers of the first couple of weeks, it was a lot of doubles. And a lot of it was because he couldn't even elevate. So those 14 homers came in a very short window prior to him getting hurt at like the end of May or beginning of June. It was unbelievable. And it actually, as good as Bo Bichette was as a prospect, he paled in comparison to Vlad, who was, you know, a third baseman, kind of first baseman. You kind of knew he was going to end up there. This guy was a shortstop, super talented, hit tool, power, speed, you know, the whole nine. Five tool kind of player, and Vlad's bat was just that good. And I'll say it's also probably the best combination of hit tool and power that I've ever seen, because he didn't even have angles. His angles have improved tremendously.
He's,
he's a better version of the guy that he was then. But just when you look at a teenager, advanced hit tool, ability to hit any kind of pitch, rarely getting fooled, and just consistently doing damage, I think he's still sort of the 80 for me when I look at, you know, hitters.
He will be the easiest 80 hit tool that'll play in the minors in my time in doing this.
Let's take you through the Arena Club Slab Pack experience. This is part two, because Todd Father last week pulled a card that he didn't love, yet he sold it back for actually more than what the Slab Pack cost. This time, pulls a card that he likes.
Yeah, and this is the best part of it. Ronnie Mauricio, the Mets standout, you know, rookie sensation. He's been absolutely phenomenal. I like the itch of seeing what you're going to get. You know, I like prospects. I don't love them, but seeing this kind of card is actually absolutely beautiful thing. I know a couple people around town that would absolutely love that card. So there's going to be a lot of conversations going on here for Arena Club.
And what you do is you have it in your digital showroom. If you want to hand it out locally, then cool, you ask Arena Club to send it to you, and they do. Or you can sell it back, like you see there, instant offer for $193, but he's keeping it. And you can do what Todd Father does by going to arenaclub.com/foul and getting 20% off your first card purchase or your first slab pack purchase.
Yeah, like, that's the easiest 80. I remember talking to a scout at that time who said, like, he was trying to map out all the ways it could go wrong. And he was like, look, it's a big body already. Like, he could get so big that, like, it affects his kind of torso rotation ability and all that. And he said, but that would only mean that he would just be one of the best hitters in the game. Like, he would still, like, that would not be enough to derail him. And it was like, if he, I remember, like, people saying, like, you know, evaluator, scout saying, if this guy doesn't hit, then I don't know what I'm doing, because this is the most clear, like, when you talk about his angles, what, that was one of the things though that made it kind of, he hit the ball extremely hard with a very level swing, which meant, and we see this even now, right? Like the play that Eugenio Suarez made, I think it was game six. Like Suarez has a couple of rough plays in that game. I'm getting game six and game seven, but I think it was game six. But there was also the play he made on a play. I think that Vlad hit that ball like 116 miles an hour. He had a ball last night, you know, as we record this in game seven, the one to Randy Arozarena, that if you'd have told me that it had gone through Arozarena's glove, you know, like broke it a la, you know, the natural or something, I'd have been like, yeah, that makes sense. He just hits the ball on a line as hard as about anybody we'll ever see. And, but it does, the thing that I, as a fan of baseball and a fan of players excelling, the thing that just stands out is he has been like, just year after year, he has his great years, he has his good years. The bad years for Vlad Jr. are good years, and the great years are truly great years. And the thing that is also amazing about that is he's 26.
My wife had asked me that last night. She was like, how old is he again? And like, Vlad is like a, you know, god in my house. Like, you know, Nolan's got posters and every baseball card and a Vlad jersey and Vlad autographs. And he met Vlad, you know, at a game at Fenway, all this sort of thing. So like, you know, it was kind of funny because she was like, he's that young, huh? And it's like, yeah, he's still only 26. I mean, the type of player he is, 10 more years of this wouldn't, I mean, maybe not at this level, but you know, 10 no, more that's years. Not,
I would say I would be disappointed if we, you know, I will be disappointed if we don't get 10 very good years continuing. Like 36.
Yeah,
that's not unreasonable.
And I'll say, like, he's better maintenance now over the last 2 years than he had ever been previously, too. So it could be a maturity thing of like a young guy just starting to take, you know, his body seriously, et cetera. So not that he's in fabulous shape, but I don't know if the Vlad of 3 or 4 years ago would have done stuff like on that pass ball the other night, stolen home, you know, like that's the kind of stuff you're seeing from him. Even the play at first base is a little bit twitchier than it had been, a little smoother. So I think that bodes well. David Ortiz was kind of like that in terms of like some reverse projection of the body getting a little better with age. Now there were some synthetic elements to that probably, but
so that's the Blue Jays, the guy who's, he is what we thought he was. There's, but then we're going to talk about on the Dodgers, the guy who's better than, and anyone. And I can say, I can honestly say, I have been following Shohei Ohtani's career for well over 10 years at this point. I mean, again, I'm trying to think of the first time I heard his name, but it was like when he was in high school. So as we get back from this break, we are going to talk about the guy who has exceeded every expectation possible. And if anyone tells you, oh yeah, I saw this coming, like, I don't believe you. I'm sorry. Don't believe you. We'll talk about that right after this quick break.
Getting the right people in the door quick is critical to maintain your company's workflow. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it puts the best and most qualified candidates in front of you quickly. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. The holidays can sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has a host of unique, high-quality, and often handmade gifts, many of which are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. That attention to detail often means products are made in small batches, so the best finds can sell out fast, like the book of famous Dodgers newspaper clippings ordered on Uncommon Goods that I received as a birthday gift. It was a special present catered to my liking that can't be found anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard baseball fans like me, to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not only finding the best and most unique gifts for the people you care about, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice and have donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/BA2022. That's uncommongoods.com/BA2022 for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
So, Jeff, Shohei Ohtani was like, is a one of one in so many ways. You know, if you are new to baseball, you may not even remember. Like, this was a guy who absolutely could have come over to the U.S. straight out of high school and have been a star and have been like a huge signing. But he wanted, in part, he stayed in Japan because he wanted to be a two-way player. And he knew he actually had the leverage to have a chance to be a two-way player in Japan. And he did it. And then he comes over to the U.S. And basically, by the way, if you don't remember, comes over to the U.S. after the collective bargaining agreement had just been modified to essentially keep him from coming over. I don't know another way to put it. Like, I called it at the time the Shohei Ohtani rule, because they changed the age at which you could come over as a foreign professional from overseas to the U.S. And it went from 23 to 25. And considering that Shohei Ohtani was, I believe, 23 at that time, that should have been like, wait 2 years now. You have to wait 2 years because then you can come over, you can be posted, you can sign for $150, $250 million. And Shohei Ohtani, who is one of one, said, nah, I'll just come over now. I want to play in the U.S., which again, if you do remember, set off the strangest bidding war that we'll ever see. Because we saw, you know, we've seen this now with Roki Sasaki in a smaller version of this. But with Shohei Ohtani, it was a case where all teams had a chance. The Twins were trying to gather, bonus pool money to make a better offer. You had, obviously, every team in baseball wanted Shohei Ohtani at that time. And he chooses the Angels. And I want to flip it back to you for a minute here, because the thing that understandably there was a lot of skepticism at this time was Shohei Ohtani said that he was going to do something that no one had ever successfully done. And to preempt it, yes, I would completely agree. We don't know if Babe Ruth could have, because there was no DH in 1916, 17, 18, 19, or the entirety of Babe Ruth's career. If there was a DH, would Babe Ruth have pitched and hit? We'll never know, because there wasn't one. So back then, you had to either be an outfielder or a pitcher, and so he chose the right decision. But no one had ever pulled off being a two-way player of any significance. And Brooks Kieschnick and Michael Lorenzen and a couple of guys here and there have done it a little bit, but no one had ever done it as even a regular. And there was a lot of skepticism on that. But there was also, do you remember, there was a lot of skepticism on just what kind of hitter he was going to be. And it is crazy that here we sit here now 7 years removed from that, because that was 2018. And hitting is actually, like, as great a pitcher as he is, I would say, one of the, when he's healthy, one of the 15 best pitchers in the world. I think that's fair. Maybe 10. But you, no one would say, okay, if you just, all you could get is Shohei Ohtani pitching, do you want Paul Skeens or do you want Shohei Ohtani? Do you want Terry Skubel or do you want Shohei Ohtani? I'd take those guys. As a hitter, okay, there's Aaron Judge and then there's him. That's kind of the list, isn't it? So, yeah. What, I mean, what do you think, like, how surprised have you been by just how impressive a hitter he's become?
I think it's the hitting side where, you know, I knew he was fast. I knew there was a lot of power. You know, I had some questions on the hit tool. And I think early, like, those were probably justified. There were some adjustments that he made, you know, once he sort of came over and was with the Angels early. You know, like, those offensive seasons weren't always great. They obviously weren't bad, but he's hit, you know, another level really since 2023. From being sort of a very good power hitter with, you know, some swing and miss, to being, you know, one of the most dominant forces we've ever seen at the plate. You know, over the last, whatever, 3 years, he's effectively,
really, I would say,
I think, yeah, 150, 149 regular season home runs. And then on top of it, you know, you saw the pitching, you know, sort of in 2023 and again this year, and we've seen it even be even more dominant if they've stretched him out into the playoffs. So it'll be interesting to see what we get next year if we get, you know, another sort of elite two-way season out of Ohtani. I think it's completely plausible that that happens. But yeah, I think I'm less surprised with the pitching. I think coming over, I thought it was one of the best pitchers in the world who also was like a top 100 bat, where now it's more like a top 20-ish starter in the world, 15, with a top two bat, you know, and probably top 30 all time. I think even top 100 all time is probably too light. So I think
I would say, yeah, like,
what he's exceeded has definitely been as a hitter as opposed to the pitcher. I think he's been kind of what I anticipated he would be as a pitcher.
To go what you just said, last three seasons, 2023 through 25 as a hitter, 298, 397, 640, averaging 30 doubles, 8 triples, 51 homers, and 33 steals. That's the average, right? Like, that's, he is the thing that stands out, and obviously he is a two-way player, but if you look at, like, on by wins above replacement, he ranks among the top, you know, like, he's not in Trout range. He's not, you know, like, he's not at the top of active players, but he's in the top 25 and he's around players who've played many more seasons than him. Like, there's still so much to come. The thing that I'll say as far as that, when Ohtani came over, he already, there was never a point where Shohei Ohtani was small, right? I don't want to make it sound like there was ever a point where he was slight. But seeing Ohtani back then and then seeing him compared to now, it is dramatic just how much further he has filled out, which I do think plays a role. Like, he's just so physically imposing now. A little bit of story time here. So, like I said, we've covered beat Ohtani. Ben Badler, I would say, did a lot of it. But back when we were actually all at BA, for, if you go back and you look at old Ohtani coverage, we didn't know he was always O-T-A-N-I. Like, when he was in Japan, because again, it's a transliteration of a character. And so, like, it's not always 100% until someone comes over, like, I want to be O-H-T-A-N-I. So it was always O-T-N-I. O-T-A-N-I for Shohei Ohtani. But when he was in Japan, it was like, already it was like, this is amazing. You're seeing 100 miles an hour fastballs at a time when you really didn't ever see that in Japan. mammoth home runs. Although, again, the hitting was a little bit more erratic at that time. Really a good outfielder, too. He would, you know, he did do that in Japan that he's never really done in the U.S. But so he comes over, and I remember I got lucky. I was on the backfields. I heard that Ohtani was going to throw a backfield sim game on the backfields at Angels camp. And this is the week before the major league season. And it is a sim game against low-level Angels minor leaguers. And Kevin Maiton, who had just become an Angel because he had been a free agent from the Braves because of their international signing illegalities and had been declared free agent. Levon Soto, another one of those guys, was on that team. Guys like that. Guys who did not really have full season experience, right? And they're facing Ohtani. And Ohtani is like 91 to 93 on the mound. Cannot throw strikes. When he does throw strikes, he's getting hit. They roll the first inning on Shohei Ohtani. Like, okay, let's roll it. Like, we're not going to just have him out here throwing. So, like, I think he got an out or two in the first, and then they rolled it. Second, if I remember right, they rolled it again. And, I mean, I'm sitting here watching this, and I'm like, what, trying to figure out what to make of this, because he's terrible. I mean, I don't have another way to describe it. It's like, I know what I saw in Japan, and this bears no relation to it, right? Like, he's throwing 91 to 93. And again, I know it's a sim game, not adrenaline and all that, but I'm like, I saw 100. So that little sim game wraps up, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, okay, I'm thinking to myself, I've witnessed this, I've got video and all this. How big a deal do I make of this? And then I told myself, it's like, JJ, you've seen him in Japan. You know this isn't what he's normally like. It's a sim game. So I tweeted about it. I mentioned like Ohtani had a rough day or whatever. But I didn't like, oh, Ohtani looks like he's a disaster. You know, the Angels are going to really rue the day or anything. Nothing like that, thankfully. Thankfully. Because then the next, he makes his MLB debut, I think against the A's, and utterly shoves. He's like 97, 98. And it's like, And I did. I breathed a sigh of relief, not because, I mean, we had been writing about Ohtani and how good he was. So I breathed a sigh of relief from that standpoint. But I really breathed a sigh of relief that I didn't like try to make any sweeping generalizations of, hey, be really concerned about this Ohtani kid. Doesn't look nearly as good. I thankfully realized that this could not be what he was going to be. And I'm very glad that I didn't, that, you know, that we, again, Ohtani was, here's what I would say. We talked at that time, that top 100. I remember us talking about how it's like it was a year where there was like no wrong answer. You know, I mean, there really wasn't. But that was the year, and I want to make sure that I pull this up right. And so, yeah, it was Ronald Acuna, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and Shohei Ohtani, right? And we said at the time, these are three prospects that in any normal year, any one of them's number one, and you're thrilled they're number one. We went with Acuna number one because, again, there was some concern about Ohtani coming over. Can you do the two-way? Can you, you know, is he going to be a star hitter and a star pitcher? All that. We're sorry. We apologize. We got it wrong. Ronald Acuna is an MVP. Ronald Acuna is one of the best players in baseball. But if we had, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is an MVP, one of the best players in baseball. But if we had to do over again, yes, Shohei Ohtani would have been our number one prospect at the time because those guys, as you know, we talked about this, like the 3 home run, 6 inning, shutout inning, 10K game is, you know, you could argue the greatest game in postseason history. We can talk about.
I would honestly argue that that might be the greatest performance in like North American team sports history, just from a single game of being able to do all those things. I can't think of anything that's even close.
Because that's the thing I would say is that like you can say, I've heard people say he's a generational player, and I just want to keep making this point. He's not a generational player. Generational players come around once a generation. Mike Trout is a generational player. I know he's been hurt lately and all, but Mike Trout had a stretch where he was, for 5, 6, 7 years, the best player in baseball. That is a generational player. But if you said
Aaron Judge,
generational player, you can say like he is the best player of this era and he stacks up with the best players of other eras, right? Like you can say how Mike Trout compared to Barry Bonds pre-PED edition, right? Or you can say how does Aaron Judge compare to Mark McGwire PED edition or things like that. Those are generational players. We have no one there's no one to compare Shohei Ohtani to because no one else has done this. And again, I will note Babe Ruth did get a chance to because he had to choose one or the other because you could not DH. But Shohei Ohtani has now done the hitting at an elite level for numerous years, and he's done pitching at an elite level, I would say for 3.5 years, almost 3 years, let's say. And we're seeing it right here in the postseason. It's remarkable. And as great as there are so many great players, Shohei Ohtani is the one who I think that when I'm, old and more decrepit than I am now, I will look back on and say, I got to see him play in person. I'm proud of that. I'm excited about that I did on multiple occasions. I saw him play before he ever made his major league debut. I watched him in Japan, video and all that, when he was before he ever came to the U.S. All those things. It's like, he's the player that I'm going to think back on and go, gather around, grandkids, and let Pap tell you a story about the player he got to see. That's the player that I'm going to talk about because he's that special.
Yeah, I think it's like once in a lifetime kind of a player, right? Which goes beyond generational. Like you'll see multiple generational players throughout your life. Where this is the kind of player where I don't know if there's ever been anybody, even Babe Ruth, because like you go back 100 and something years, it's hard to compare eras 50 year split, let alone 120. So that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I think I've been fortunate enough to see him play in person. I didn't see him in person before he came over. I didn't see him in spring training and wasn't doing this full time at that point. But I did get to see one of his highlight moments prior to winning a World Series last year.
One of the great moments in baseball.
Yeah, where, I saw him hit. I saw him take BP. Saw him, win the WBC and obviously strike out Mike Trout. And then I got to ask the first question in the press conference actually after. So, that was kind of a cool little footnote and stood next to him. And I will tell you, you talked about the, added muscle and mass on Ohtani. He's listed at 210 pounds. There is no chance he weighs anything less than like 235, 240. He is humongous. I mean, he's every bit as big as every NFL QB, linebacker that I've been around. He's taller. And he's just as muscular and broad. I mean, he is a massive, massive human being. And then obviously an elite athlete on top of that.
An exceptional athlete. That's the other – the other part of it is this. The one thing I am a little disappointed that we haven't gotten to see in the U.S., and I get it. I really do. But he could play in an absolutely – again, he's now 30. It's not like the same as when he was 22. But, we see it on the base pass. If you put him in the outfield, like you are talking about a rangy outfielder who, by the way, has a 9 arm, So when you talk about a prototypical right fielder, Shohei Ohtani is the prototype. We just don't get to see it because he's too good as a pitcher to not, and that's the perfect segue then into the next thing we want to talk about here. When we talk about how these teams were built, I'll kind of ask you the question. Again, might work on this as a story for later in the week, but if you want to caveat that this is not the Braves rotation where you could count on Greg Maddux and Tom Glavin and John Smoltz and take your pick of Steve Avery or Denny Nagel or whatever. You had four guys, usually Charlie Lee Brandt. You had four or five guys who could be counted on for 200 plus innings. This is not that rotation. No, not close. If you want to say maybe one of those Yankees rotations where you had Mussina, where you had Clemens, where you had, like, you could pick out some of those rotations that were very good. But if you asked me, if you said a rotation built for the postseason in the, let's call it the modern era by this standard, like if you want to say Koufax, you know, like if you can absolutely go to the 63 World Series where you had 63 World Series, Dodgers, Yankees, Dodgers facing a Yankees team that had Mantle and Maris and Berra and Hall of Famers all over it. And they allowed four runs, I believe, in four games. Not only that, their starters pitched all but two-thirds of an inning of those four games because Koufax had two starts, Drysdale won, and Padres won, and they all dominated. Padres actually left after eight in the third, so that did give Laurent Paranowski a chance to throw two-thirds of an inning of relief. So if you – I mean, it's hard to compare that to what we're talking about now where you have – the Dodgers had a wild card round and then a division series round and then the LCS, and now they have the World Series. But that said, this rotation, the way that Yamamoto is pitching, the way Shohei Ohtani is pitching, the way that Tyler Glasnow is pitching, the way Blake Snell is pitching, this rotation to me, you could make the argument that this is, we'll see what they do in the World Series. Obviously, they have to do that for this to be the case. But I think you could argue that this is the best rotation built for a postseason that you really can almost that has been constructed. Not that you could construct, because obviously you could add Tarek Skubal and Paul Skenes to it or something, but that has been constructed. Am I overboard there?
No, I think, you know, you look at all these guys, you have a multi-Cy Young winner in Blake Snell, Tyler Glasnow, who, you know, durability has kind of been the issue with Glasnow.
If but misses bats anytime he's healthy.
Yeah. I mean, if you get you ever got a 200 inning season from Glasnow, he probably wins a Cy Young. You have Shohei Ohtani, who we've discussed ad nauseum at this point. And then Yamamoto, who frankly, for my money, is a top five pitcher in the big leagues.
He's the definition of an ace.
Yeah. I think he's like kind of the ace of the staff, but the funny thing is you could say that about any of these guys. Like, he's been worth another big contract that the Dodgers shelled out. You know, it was the biggest free agent contract for a pitcher in history. He had not thrown a single pitch stateside yet at that point. And he's been worth every penny this far. You know, tremendous season, and he's still 27 years old. As long as he stays healthy, he's somebody who's going to anchor this rotation for the better part of probably the next decade. So, you know, I think you look at all of these guys, and even Yamamoto, who maybe has less stripes over here or whatever, is coming off an absolutely, you know, phenomenal five war season at 27 years old. So, and I actually think it was his age 26 season because he turned 27 in August. So a lot of years left with that guy. And I think, you know, is as good as any pitcher in the game. And he can show you so many different looks. I think we kind of knew that when he came over, but there was velocity, kind of enough release traits and fastball traits and command, and then tons of feel for spin, and, you know, quality off-speed stuff as well. So it's kind of like the total package when it comes to the pitch mix between the curveball, the slider, you know, as a sinker, cutter, splitter. It's like you kind of have six different pitch shapes coming at you. I would almost say it's probably the closest thing we've seen to Yu Darvish since Yu Darvish came over. And I even think that includes domestic players too. Just a deep arsenal and a lot of different traits.
And so I want to talk about, like you said about Glasnow, that if he ever throws 200 innings, he will to Cy Young. Well, Blake Snell is the definition of that. Blake Snell has qualified for the ERA title twice, and he's won two Cy Youngs. So, like, literally any season that Blake Snell is healthy enough to throw 165 innings, he wins the Cy Young. Like, but when I say the perfect postseason rotation, I think that's kind of part of this, right? Like, we wrote about this today, piece about, or yesterday when you can get this, about the number, the decline of the number four starter. And one of the things I would say with that is like, I think that whether by design or providence, the Dodgers, I think it's good in their ways that Tyler Glasnow missed time. And then I don't think they rushed any of these guys back. Yamamoto obviously took his turn all year. But the Dodgers won 106 games a few years ago. They've checked that box. They didn't even win the division that year. They checked that box and it did them no good, right? It didn't make them any better. They now, when you say about their resources and how much they spend and all that, one of the things that it does kind of allow them to do is to say, hey, Clayton Kershaw, Emmett Sheehan, Dustin May before we trade you, Tony Gonsolin until you get hurt, Ben Kasperius, Justin Robleski. We could just go down the line. They have all these pitchers who their job is to get the team to September. And it really was September that all of a sudden you had a healthy Snell, a healthy Glasnow, a stretched out healthy Ohtani back from TJ, and Yamamoto. And from that point on, it's like, yep, this is the team that everyone's feared all year. And we've seen this in the postseason, obviously, just mowing through opponents. But what I'd say about that is having Blake Snell fresh, having Tyler Glass, you know, having Glasnow fresh, having Ohtani fresh is a benefit for the Dodgers at this time of year. Okay, a very short little aside with that. Like, we have the Snell outing already. If Snell has another outing like that in the World Series, normally there is a limit where I would say, do not, you know, you got to pull the pitcher. You know, you can't let a guy throw 130, 140 pitches in a game, even if he's, you know, got a perfect game or whatever. Blake Snell in the World Series is the exception I would have to that, which is like, he has this fascinating career. Like we said, he has two Cy Youngs, but he also is the guy who I would say right now, even as good as his career's been, and it's been a great career, I think it's kind of known more for the fact that he has 1,158 innings in 10 seasons. The fact that he's 81-62, and I know wins don't matter that much, but 81-62 with a 3.15 ERA, 10 seasons into his MLB career. I would love to see him have a chance to take a no-hitter, a complete game no-hitter in the World Series or something like that. He almost had one of those, you know, obviously in the LCS, just because it would change his, you know, his career trajectory in some ways. Because as great as he is with two Cy Youngs, I think he gets remembered for he's the guy who nibbles, who doesn't throw that many innings, and never seems to qualify for ERA titles. He fits this, Glasnow fits this, but these guys are doing it in the postseason. The stat that also jumps out, these four starters threw less than 50% of the Dodgers' starting pitching innings in the regular season. In the postseason so far, they're throwing almost 80% of their total innings. It's okay. That kind of drives us to the next point, which is, but you're seeing with the Blue Jays, this Blue Jays rotation that we have now is not the Blue Jays rotation that we saw in April, May, or June either. And it's not just Treya Savage, but it does stand out like that Treya Savage is an example of how, what I would say is to kind of tee you off on this, how the Blue Jays processes have improved.
Yeah, and I think things are just very deliberate. There were changes made at the top over the last couple of years in terms of their hitting development as well as their pitching development. They put a ton of money in the last few years into that facility in Dunedin, really redid the whole player development system. Everything is brand new, top notch. I mean, I try to hit as many games as I possibly can there, not just because I cover the Blue Jays, but because it's covered. They have plugs outside at the backfields and it's just sort of, they've spared no expense. And I think that's one of the reasons they've been able to compete with the big free agents that they have. But they've also invested in pitching development pretty heavily. They brought in Justin Lear. They have Ricky Meinhold, who had been with the Mets and some other places before that. Ricky's job was kind of just to look at the processes that they had and make some suggestions. Justin kind of you know, turned on the turbo boosters in terms of, you know, applying a different perspective and a different philosophy. And a lot of it was about like intended targeting and that sort of thing with pitching, trying to zone stuff. A lot of it was around command and control and trying to throw your best stuff in the zone. And I think we saw pitchers throughout their system take massive steps forward in terms of that strike throwing, et cetera. I also think they were really strategic about how they deployed Savage starting the season in Dunedin. You're in good weather, et cetera, as things start to heat up and he proves himself to be dominating low A. He then gets boosted up to Vancouver. He's there for a handful of starts. They were kind of running him in tandem piggyback with Gage Stanifer, another arm that broke out big for them this year. Once he got promoted, Savage to New Hampshire, then all of a sudden Stanifer had kind of the training wheels off and he was starting games in place of Savage. Savage goes to double A pitch as well, triple A. They bring him up to the big leagues. He gets whatever, two or three starts. And now is, you know, pitched in the playoffs and pitched pretty well, but they kept some innings open for him. I think the other thing that they did was when they drafted this guy, they liked the stuff. They were less concerned about some of the injury stuff than other people did. And they really were impressed by how he competed, how he handled innings, wanted the ball, went deep into all of his starts. And, you know, in a lot of games where ECU was facing higher ranked teams, you know, they came away with a victory, or at least, you know, when he came out of that game, had a puncher's chance at a W. So I think you sort of look at that. He had those intangibles of a rotation guy right from the jump, regardless of some of the questions around, you know, the unusual mechanics and the way over the top arm slot. And then some of the medicals and stuff around shoulders and elbows that were kind of whispered behind the scenes, you know, in draft circles with other teams. So, you know, good on them. And I think even beyond that, last year, you know, they nailed the Cal Steven pick. They're then able to go out and acquire Justin Bieber. He was another guy that came through that Blue Jays.
Shane Bieber.
I said Justin?
You said Justin.
Wow. Shane Bieber.
It's been a long week. I mean, we're staying up at night watching games.
I'm just bad with names. But anyway, so they acquire, he's Canadian, at least. They acquire Shane Bieber, you know, in the Cal Steven trade. And then the third round pick that they had when they went 1-2-3 with pitchers was Johnny King, who's a borderline top 100 prospect. And, you know, of the young pitching prospects, at least in my systems, I've been getting some of the loudest feedback on him from outside evaluators. So overall, they did really, really well in terms of pitching throughout the system. And I think that there's a philosophy, you know, there's certainly relievers here. You know, Fisher was another great pickup. They're going after different types of players in the draft and in free agency and on the trade market. And I think a lot of that has to do with some synergy now between, you know, player development and acquisitions and just how they communicate. And I've had the scouting department tell me that directly.
So you hit on it. Like having it, I think it's a massive developmental win. Not that just to develop Treya Savage. Treya Savage is first round pick. It's not like, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, there are developmental wins where you're like, that guy was, you know, an eighth round pick and 2 years later is in the big leagues and all that. Treya Savage is first round pick. He was an elite prospect coming into the draft. But to have him develop the way he has, where, as you said, he was ready to make this impact all through October, right? Like, that's the part that is not easy. That's the part that a lot of teams have 100% screwed up over the years, where, I mean, to just point out the biggest screw up of all screw ups on this, like the Steven Strasburg year, we're like, yeah, we're making the postseason, but we've run out of innings for our best pitcher. Oops, we want to protect him. I don't know how, you know, again, I don't know if that did or not, but I will tell you this. Developmentally, that was a loss. Developmentally, when you say we're a team that has an ace, but the ace ran out of innings because we didn't figure out a way to get him to October, is not a way to do it. It's just not what the Blue Jays have done here, where they, I didn't even say slow played him, but they did it in a way where they're like, it's important that he's going to be at his best at the most important time of the year in the games that matter the most, because the games don't matter in the Florida State League like they matter in the postseason in Toronto. And he's done it. And I don't, and they are not, and let's just be clear, they are not here. We are not talking about the Blue Jays on this World Series preview podcast without that. No, I mean, that's just simple as enough. But the other thing about this is I do want to kind of touch on this a little bit more, talk a little bit more Blue Jays here, which is, but it's also guys like Addison Barger, right? It's also guys like Alejandro Kirk is a developmental success story, and it's a credit to Kirk, but it's also a credit to them, because, you know, this is a team that at one point they had Kirk, they had Danny Jansen, and they had Gabriel Moreno. And I will tell you right now, it was a somewhat unconventional decision at that time to say Gabriel Moreno, who is the embodiment of what your young, going to be a face of the franchise, long-term durable catcher looks like. Gabriel Moreno looks like that. To say, no, we believe in Kirk, who, as we all can say, like, who's a really good catcher, but body-wise, like, when he was coming up, he looked like this. He looked like the guy where you're like, catcher? Is that guy going to be able to stay at catcher? And he has, and he's very good at it, and he can hit. He's been an incredibly valuable part of their team. And that's a developmental win. Addison Barger is a developmental win. You could, you know, like signing Ernie Clement off the scrap heap and having him be a very useful and valuable player. There are George Springer's bounce back, obviously, is a win. But to me, there are some of these players like Kirk, like Barger, like guys like that, that really fit into kind of this story as well. Like, you know, that really are kind of vital to this, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about Vlad Jr. We know what kind of win that was. It was obviously a big signing from the moment he signed. But I think you do look at Kirk now and, you know, had a couple of seasons where he dealt with some injuries and the bat wasn't quite there. But has put together 2.4+ war seasons now, is kind of sneaky one of the best defensive catchers in the game. You know, I think that was one of the things that I enjoyed most about the Seattle-Toronto series, where you were seeing two great defensive catchers out there, that there weren't a lot of misplays. And, you know, both very good blockers, good framers. Riley might be a little bit better of a thrower than Kirk is, but Kirk isn't a bad thrower, of course. Had a nice pick throw last night, almost picked off a play at first base. But, you know, I think you look at him too, just from the standpoint of the bar is lower for catchers offensively. And he doesn't have a ton of power despite having all this mass, right? But he's one of the hardest guys in baseball to strike out. He takes his walks, hits for consistent average, kind of puts the ball in play when you need him to, does a lot of those things that I think maybe go unnoticed in sort of the stat line, waxing poetic like a 70-year-old baseball coach right now. But you know, I think catchers like this who, you know, provide above average to average-ish offense are worth their weight in gold if they're a plus defensive catcher. And that's what you get with Kirk. And I think we see with teams that win, quality catching more often than not is kind of the backbone of those teams. You know, we look at Seattle, obviously good catching. Will Smith, you know, good catching, you know, there as well. And, you know, William Contreras, who's been one of the best catchers in baseball as well for the Brewers. The final four teams even all had kind of had elite catchers. I think you need a guy like that to get here. Speaking on Barger, I think there's still more left in the tank. I think we saw an inconsistently really good season for him this year. maybe is better long-term at third than he is in the outfield, but you're probably not going to see a lot of run at third with a guy like Ernie Clement. You know, but offensively,
I mean,
he has
played some in the postseason even there.
Yeah. But, you know, hit 21 home runs, you know, can drive in runs. He's always going to strike out a decent amount. He's never going to walk a ton, but still only 25. And I think that, you know, we haven't necessarily scratched the surface on what the ceiling is. This could turn into like a 30 homer bat. It could go the other way. I think as we see the contact continue to improve, but he had a really good year, kind of some ups and some downs. But overall was, you know, an above average bat for them and is a pretty solid defender at multiple positions, has a plus arm in the outfield or at third base. He's a really useful piece for him. And I think, you know, some of, we'll say more of the role players on this team have a lot of versatility, can play a few different positions. And I think that's helpful in terms of, you know, when they get into, you know, situations strategically where they need to put their best defense out there or, you know, spell a guy if there's, you know, struggles or injuries, et cetera. You know, they are sort of equipped with a decent bench to be able to do some of those things. So I think Barger is still on the upswing. I think we're kind of seeing Kirk in his peak right now. And, you know, frankly, I think is probably, even with as good as George Springer has been, he might be the second most valuable position player on this team behind Vlad, just for all that he provides you behind the plate.
Well, we're going to see if Bo Bichette, he says he's ready. We'll see if he joins back as well, which obviously will be a big boost. Okay, we'll end this. I'm going to do another prediction, but any thoughts you have on what you think is going to happen in the World Series?
All right, so I'm going to stick, you know, I had picked, I think, the Dodgers to win the World Series before the year, but I'm going to go against that. I'm going to say the Blue Jays shock the world in seven games. We get a great classic series and they end up winning. I think there is this. I would not listen to this as betting advice, though. I would not listen to this as betting advice, but I do think if the scenario where the Blue Jays win is they're the first team that can get to the Dodgers starting pitching, because everybody 1 through 9 provides really good at bats. There's a lot of guys that can hit for contact. They aren't fooled by breaking balls. And there's a lot more power in this lineup than there was in the Brewers lineup. So I think some of the things that we thought could work in the favor of the Brewers, the Blue Jays have that. Plus they have a lot more impact, even from their bottom of the lineup. Guys can still sneak a couple of homers. It's more 15 homer power as opposed to like 5 to 10, like a lot of those Brewers guys. They're a really good defensive team. They make a lot of plays in the infield. It'll be interesting to see if maybe Springer gets moved to an outfield spot if he's healthy enough, because Bichette maybe is best as just the DH right now. I really like the way the infield looks with Jimenez and IKF, though. I think that's one of the things. It's been a huge benefit for them. They don't win those games if they don't have that middle infield defense.
No, I don't. I follow what you're saying. If Springer's knee's okay now, obviously he took a ball off of it, like, that would be, I could see where that, or like, I could also see, got a few days here, you know, like, does Bo Bichette become like, is it possible that he becomes a second baseman maybe for a couple, you know, for, is that crazy to think?
Like, I don't know.
I think that he's not, like, you do not want him going right back out there to shortstop. Their defense is too good right now.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is. And, you know, then the question becomes, like, is Nathan Lucas, who's been really good for them, kind of out? At the same time, if I'm sacrificing Nathan Lucas's bat when he's, you know, that's not killing me. I mean, he's been fine. He's, you know, moved runners along. He's had a good playoffs. Right. But, you know, I don't know if that's a massive difference. I think it's maybe the difference between him as an all-around player versus what you feel you get from IKF, just in terms of the bat. It's probably going to be that Bichette slides into shortstop if he is a full go, and then Jimenez, you know, platinum glove at second base, moves back to his natural position. But Jimenez has played great there. I think that's a benefit. They are a very strong defensive team, I think, kind of in the outfield, in the infield. Obviously, we just talked about Kirk's catching. But the pitching worries me against the Dodgers, frankly. I think I'd be crazy not to say that. They now get to kind of reset the rotation a little bit. I assume they'll probably go Gausman, maybe a Savage again in game two, because they like to pitch him at home as opposed to on the road. And then we would see Bieber, Scherzer, and then potentially Gausman or maybe even Bassett. I don't know, but probably Gausman if they made it that far into game five. And then whatever happens in game six and seven, kind of all hands on deck at that point. It would be great to see it be a series. You know, I'm going to pick the Blue Jays here, but I wouldn't bet my money on it.
I'm going to say Dodgers in five.
Yeah.
I hope you're right. I want it seven. Pick. I want seven, but I'm going to say that's Dodgers
probably in five. Smart pick.
Yeah. I just think this rotation right now, I do think that, yes, I think the Blue Jays lineup has enough to do some damage here, but the rotation is just so dominant right now, you know. And Roky Sasaki does give them actually looks like a closer, you know, makes the bullpen deeper than we thought it was, you know, which obviously we thought it was shallower than shallow, and it hasn't really mattered yet because their rotation has been so good. We'll see. It's going to be fascinating. We're all excited to see it. We'll have more here at baseballamerica.com. We'll have more podcasting. We're going to do another full World Series preview, focusing more on the matchups and all that. For Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.